morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, and we're discussing his widely acclaimed book, What Went Wrong. Professor Lewis, glad to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here with you.
In this book, you chronicle the ways in which Islamic influence in the world has declined over the past, most noticeably, I suppose, over the past few hundred years. And then you ask, what went wrong? Why did it decline? And sort of wonder what might it and we do to change their role in the world. But in order to get a fresh understanding on what did go wrong, I think it'd be helpful to give the listener a brief synopsis of the ways and the extent to which the Islamic world was seen as the center of civilization for so many centuries.
Yes, I think one has to make a distinction between history as the records or traces left by what happened and history as what people make of those records or traces. And these are three closely related things, obviously, but they're not identical, and we use the word history in all three senses. The theme of my book is basically the awareness among Muslims that things had gone wrong, how they became aware of it, how they tried to explain it, how they tried to remedy it. If one looks at the process in a long historical perspective, in a broad geographical context, obviously one has to say that this was a very complex process that was going on over a very long period of time, in different ways, in different places, and so on. But, of course, that isn't how people see things. People don't see things in a broad geographical context and a long historical perspective, and certainly not in the pre-modern era before the invention of modern communications. So the question that I tried to look at was, when did the Muslims become aware that they were no longer the most advanced civilization and the greatest power in the world? When did they begin to become aware of that? And then, as I remarked before, how did they explain it? And how did they try to remedy it? People talk a lot nowadays about the clash of civilizations. And I think it's a good term. I've used it myself. But I think one has to be careful what one means. There are many civilizations in human history, in Europe, in Asia and Africa, in pre-Columbian America. But all but two of them are what you might call regional. They grow up in one region. They are created and carried by people of one or at the most a couple of related ethnic groups. There are only two civilizations which are religiously defined and universal in their aspirations and perceptions, and those are Christianity and Islam. And these were brought into conflict not by their differences, but by their resemblances. When a Christian and a Muslim cleric argued in the Middle Ages, and either one said to the other, "You are an infidel and you will burn in hell," each understood exactly what the other meant, because they meant pretty much the same thing. That kind of discourse would have been meaningless to a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Confucian. They could understand each other, even if it was only to argue. And that, I think, is the best hope for the future. Maybe those resemblances will give rise to dialogue instead of conflict. But we don't seem to be there yet.
Could you maybe just take a couple of minutes, though, and give the listener a sense of just how dominant Islam was and the ways in which it was dominant, militarily, in terms of their appreciation of the arts, the sciences, and really how long this went on?
Certainly. You know, in our history books, we talk of the period called the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages being a sort of interval between the decline of ancient civilization, by which we mean Greece and Rome, and the rise of modern civilization, by which we mean ourselves. And the Middle Ages are a sort of interlude, even a sort of dark age, between the end of one civilization and the rise of another. In a global context, this simply isn't so. What in Western history we call the Middle Ages, in Islamic history, are the great and glorious era of their greatest power and their greatest achievement. The Islamic religion was born in Arabia in the 7th century, and within a remarkably short time, it had spread over a vast area into the Middle East, across North Africa, into Europe, eastwards, across Iran, into Central Asia, to India, and even into parts of China. It was the first really global civilization, not just international, but you might even say intercontinental, certainly polyethnic, bringing together many, many different racial groups. It had the inheritance of the ancient civilizations of the Middle East. It was open to new ideas coming from further east, from the great civilizations of India and China. And, of course, it created an immense amount of new material of its own. I don't think one can deny that during the centuries within European history are regarded as a sort of dark interlude in Islamic history. Were the ages of greatest achievement when they were really in the forefront of humanity in every significant field of creative endeavor, in the arts, in the sciences, in the humanities, in commerce, in philosophy, in medicine. They were also the greatest military power on earth. If you think that their armies had conquered Spain and were crossing the Pyrenees into France, had conquered Iran and were invading India and China, were extending further and further west and south in Africa. And there had never been anything like it before. This was vastly greater than the Roman Empire at its peak. And they were also very advanced, as I said, in many other respects, even in commerce. By the 10th century, you could write a check in Basra in Iraq and cash it in Morocco. They had developed a quite elaborate system of banking and finance. And then somehow things began to go wrong. They saw themselves as challenging Christianity for the, how would you put it, for the rule of the world or the enlightenment of the world, depending on the political or religious approach. And for centuries they won every war, they won every battle, they conquered and advanced. Now there were changes. In Europe, there was the Reconquista, as the Spaniards call it, and the Moors were driven out of Spain. In Russia, the Tatars, who had conquered Russia, were driven out in what the Russians call the ending of the Tatar yoke. But at the center, things were still going very well for the Muslims. They conquered the Christian land of Anatolia. They conquered the Christian city of Constantinople. And they advanced into Europe. And what happened in Spain or India was remote and peripheral. What mattered was the center. And the perception was that Islam was still winning. And if you look at it, it was not an unreasonable perception. In the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas ruling in Belgrade and in Buda, and Turkish armies besieging Vienna. And not only that, but there were Muslim corsairs from North Africa raiding the coasts of England and Ireland, and on one occasion even Iceland. So they were doing pretty well. And then came the second defeat at Vienna. They tried twice to capture Vienna, the seat of the Holy Roman Emperor, whom the Sultan saw as his opposite number, as the head of Christendom. The first siege of Vienna ended in what, in sporting language, you might call a stalemate. You might call a draw, in chess language, a stalemate. The second siege of Vienna in 1683 was an unmitigated disaster. The Turkish historian of the time describes it in these words. He says, "This is the most calamitous defeat that we have suffered since the foundation of our state." I think one must admire the candor with which he says this. Most modern historians are quite incapable of that sort of candor. The defeat of Vienna was followed by a headlong retreat through the Balkans. And in 1699, a peace treaty, the first one signed by the Ottoman Empire as a defeated power, the first peace treaty that was imposed on them by victorious enemies. And that's where the debate begins. We can date it with remarkable precision. It's just a little more than 300 years ago. And fortunately, the Turkish archives and literary resources are very rich, and we can follow it. It begins within what you might call the elite, the political, religious, bureaucratic, military elite of the Ottoman Empire. And then, as things get worse and worse, it spreads. It spreads from the elite to much wider circles. It spreads from Turkey to the rest of the Islamic world. And the debate has been going on ever since and has reached new intensity in our time.
So let me see if I understand this correctly, that part of what led many Islamic people to assume that they were the dominant civilization was that they were the dominant military power in the world. And even though they had lost what they could see as minor skirmishes around the edge of the empire,
right,
for the longest time the empire itself was secure, and so they assumed that they were preeminent and they had nothing to learn from the Westerners.
Exactly. They were willing to learn from India and China, where they saw civilizations which, although they were not Muslim, they were unbelievers in the Muslim perception, nevertheless they had reached a high level of civilization and they had useful things to teach. I mean, from India they got numbers, what we call Arabic numerals, because we got them from the Arabs, but the Arabs got them from India, decimal positional numbering. They got paper from China. Both were unknown previously. But from Europe, from the Western Christian world, they didn't see anything to learn. They saw this as a sort of outer darkness of barbarism and unbelief beyond the northwestern frontier of civilization. Their mistake was that, although this perception might have been fairly accurate in the early centuries, they held on to it long after it had ceased to be accurate, and even to a time when it had become absurdly inaccurate. And that, of course, was one of the things which led to their defeat and retreat.
Though you mention in the book that there were some leaders, particularly in the Ottoman Empire, who began to realize that the West had something going right, if nothing else, that in the realm of military power, they had something right. And so the Muslim communities began to try to get some information, some learning from the West, and that alone was seen as somehow at least acknowledging that the infidel might have something to offer them. And that was a dramatic change.
Right. Well, that, as I said, it begins with, we can date the change with remarkable precision from the Treaty of Karlovitz of 1699 and what followed afterwards. There are occasional hints before that, but it doesn't amount to anything significant. The lessons of history are most perspicuously taught on the battlefield. They lost battles, that was clear. It couldn't be explained away. They realized that something was badly wrong, particularly as they lost battle after battle, and war after war, and lost province after province. So the debate began. Now, if you become aware that something is wrong, there are two ways you can look at it. You can ask, what did we do wrong? And that leads naturally to the next question, how do we put it right? And that leads naturally to looking at other people who seem to be doing better and saying, what are they doing right? What can we learn from them? That was the approach which was followed by the Ottoman Turks and a good many others as they tried to bring about a process of modernization. The other approach, if you become aware that things are going wrong, is to say, who did this to us? And that leads into a twilight world of conspiracy theories and neurotic fantasies and so forth. And unfortunately, a significant part of the Muslim world has chosen that route. The two different routes lead to two different conclusions. The people who tried modernization went from step to step. To begin with, they first perceived the difference on the battlefield. So the first reforms were military. They decided that they must modernize their armies, that's to say, Europeanize them, bring them more into accord with the warfare of the more advanced countries, military powers of the time. They did that. It wasn't enough. They still were defeated. They decided that they weren't doing it thoroughly enough. Now, in order to militarize an army, in order to modernize an army, you need to have a series of other changes. You need educational changes because you have to educate your officers. You need economic changes because you have to clothe and equip your army. You need changes in your system of transportation because you need to move the army around and so on and so on. So once you begin these changes, they spread and they spread very rapidly, but not rapidly enough. Now, eventually, they felt that military change, though essential, wasn't in itself enough. So they began to look for other aspects. We have an Ottoman ambassador in Paris and the beginning of the 19th century, who found out about factories. And he said, well, the Europeans have invented this way of building factories and manufacturing things quickly and fairly cheaply, and therefore that is what we have to do in order to catch up with them. And he said, if the Sultan would give orders to build 5 factories, then in no time at all we will catch up. Well, of course, it wasn't as simple as that. They did build factories by order of the Sultan or the Pasha or whoever, mainly producing supplies for the armed forces of the state. And unsurprisingly, this did not produce the economic upsurge for which they had hoped. Then, in the early 19th century, they began to send student missions to Western universities to study, first in military schools and then in universities. And some of those came back with another very strange Western idea, the idea of having a written constitution and an elected assembly. And they tried that too, in one country after another, and none of them seemed to work very well. Then they began, how shall I put it, to be somewhat more introspective, to look into their own society and see what was wrong there, rather than what should they imitate. And they raise a number of interesting questions. One of them is the very sensitive, very delicate question of religion. Obviously, people in a Muslim society were not going to even ask the question, is Islam the cause of our weakness? No. But they do discuss religion, and the word they use normally is fanaticism. Religion is a good thing, and their religion is naturally for them the best, but fanaticism is a bad thing. Everyone would agree on that. And they talk about the inroads of fanaticism into the religious structure and the harm that it's doing. Fanaticism and obscurantism and the rest. It's interesting to sort of try and read between the lines. Some of them are genuine, pious Muslims trying to free Islam from what they see as perversions and distortions. Some of them are just using this language as a cover for secularism. And you get both kinds, and the debate on that is still going on. Then there's a very interesting point made by a Turkish writer in 1867. There may be earlier ones, but I don't know of any. And that is the position of women. If you look at the literature of travel, there were always people traveling between Christendom and Islam. And the one thing which they note both ways, Europeans visiting the Islamic lands, Muslims visiting Europe, is the enormous difference in the position of women. European visitors to the Islamic lands profess to be shocked by the oppression and depressed condition of women in the Islamic lands. And they also speak with barely concealed envy of what they imagine to be the rights and privileges of the Muslim male. Conversely, when Muslims visit Europe, they speak with utter astonishment of what they see as the absurd deference and dangerous freedom given to Western women. We find a number of rather striking comments along these lines. Even in Spain, where you wouldn't have thought the position of women was that free and easy. That gave rise to quite interesting literature. This Turkish writer in 1867 regards this as the main point. He says, we treat our women at best like jewels or musical instruments, and most of the time much worse than that. How can we hope to keep up with the modern world when we deprive ourselves of the talents and services of half the population? And he goes on with another striking metaphor. He says, compared with the West, our body social is like a human body that is paralyzed on one side. I think that's quite remarkable. He also points out the not unimportant detail that women are not only half the population, they are also the mothers of the other half, and therefore in charge of the early education of little boys. And he said, what good does it do us to have little boys educated in their early years by ignorant, uneducated, and downtrodden mothers? Now, the position of women in the Western world was very far from one of equality with males, but it was incomparably better than in most other places in the world for a very simple reason. The Christian religion of all churches, of all denominations, of all forms, insists on strict monogamy, one man, one wife. The Islamic religion allows both polygamy and concubinage, and that inevitably depresses the condition of women.
All right, let me just ask one quick question about modernization, and then we're going to have to move, because of the press of time, to look at this the other possible explanation. It seems that at least some people within the Islamic world realized that they needed to modernize. They made steps to modernize, but it never seemed to allow them to catch up. And it seems to me that there might be three types of explanations of what happened. One is that they just tried too late, or that it was piecemeal. They were trying to make changes one at a time rather than as a whole, or perhaps that the changes they made were only partial. They weren't complete. I wonder if any or all of those might partly explain why modernization didn't bring them the results they hoped would bring.
There is a story which is probably untrue, but it is indicative. A story of two princes from Arabia who went to England on a state visit in the 19th century. And they were given the usual official reception. They were taken around. They were shown an army barracks, a battleship, a factory, a school, and so on and so forth. And before they left to go home, the gentleman from the Foreign Office, who was in charge of the hospitality, said that Her Majesty's government would like to give them a farewell gift. What would they like to have of the various things they had seen? And they said, no, our journey was sufficient. We don't need any gifts. The gentleman from the Foreign Office knew his business, and he insisted the appropriate number of times. And then finally, in accordance with etiquette, they conceded that there was something they would like. And he said, what is it? We'll arrange it for you. And they said, well, we noticed in the bathrooms you have a little basin and then a kind of faucet. You turn it and water comes. That would be very useful to take back home. A lot of the reforms were faucets without plumbing. They just borrowed the results of modernization.
Yes, that would be apocryphal story for sure.
Yes, I'm sure it's an apocryphal story, but I think it makes a good point. A lot of the reforms were like that.
What about, we've got about five minutes left here, what about this other alternative, the fact that some people ask, what did the West do to us? That's the source of the problem.
Well, it's not only the West. I mean, the blame game has been going on for a long time. The first people to blame were the Mongols, the great Mongol invasions of the 13th century, which they say destroyed the great Islamic civilization. Well, that really doesn't stand up to close examination. I mean, for one thing, if a few thousand nomadic horsemen riding across the steppe from East Asia were able to destroy the mighty empire of the caliphs of Baghdad, there must have been something very wrong with it. And then it looks even worse as an explanation if you consider what happened after the Mongol invasions. And that is that areas which were conquered by the Mongols, like Iran, did rather better than the areas which had not been conquered by the Mongols, like North Africa. And then, of course, there was the European imperialism. As they see it, of course, when the Muslims invaded Europe, that was fine. They were bringing them civilization and the true faith. When, after 1,000 years or so of Muslim invasion, the Europeans in turn invaded the Muslim lands, that was imperialism. To blame the European imperialist invasion for what went wrong seems to me to be confusing causes and effects. And the European advance was a result of what went wrong, not a cause of it. It was because things had gone wrong that these previously despised people of Europe were able first to expel them and then to follow them home. But nowadays, of course, one goes in for all sorts of conspiracy theories. At the moment, the two favorite culprits are the Americans and the Jews.
In the last sort of 3 minutes of the show, what should the stance... I mean, it's hard to tell another civilization what they should do, but if you were going to give them advice, if you were going to suggest to them what they might do at the current point in history of the world, and what we might do, what kind of advice would you give?
Well, to them, I would say, stop playing the blame game. Look at your own history. Look at your own society. See where you have gone wrong and put it right. Try to become part of the modern world and not go in for fantasies and the blame game. To us, I would say we cannot cure their disease. Only they can do that. But we can refrain from putting obstacles in the way and refrain from encouraging negative elements and forces in their society.
What sort of obstacles can or do we put in the way, and in what ways might we encourage those negative elements in their society?
Well, let me tell you what is now a common accusation. I mean, obviously, the age of imperialism in the classical sense has ended. There are now, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, which was the last of the great European empires, there is no imperial domination in the classical sense of that term. What they complain of now is what they call puppet governments imposed on them. They look at their own governments and they see that for the most part they are governed by corrupt tyrants who are inefficient in everything except survival. And they see that most of these are governments that we in the West are pleased to call our friends and allies. And therefore they regard us as responsible for them. And in some degree, one must concede that there is some justice in this accusation. The general principle of foreign policy in Europe, and now also in America, has been on the underlying assumption that these people are incapable of producing a civilized modern government. They will be governed by corrupt tyrants. So the aim of our policy should be to ensure that they're friendly tyrants, not hostile tyrants. This is the line that was pursued in Central America and in Southeast Asia, and in due course gave rise to a Cuba and a Vietnam. We haven't yet got to that point in the Middle East. I hope we never do.
So you think there are things that we have done which have exacerbated the problems and might prolong it?
Yes, I do.
And therefore that there are things that we could do to at least enable them?
Yes. As I say, I think we should, A, refrain from placing obstacles on the way, and B, where necessary, help in removing obstacles. Saddam Hussein is an obvious example of both.
Someone that we helped prop up, at least initially.
Yes.
Right. Any last very particular suggestions that you could give to people who want to try to do things to lessen the tensions between Christianity and Islam?
Well, I think the more we know about it, the better. I always believe in the value of knowledge. There is an incredible amount of nonsense being put about Islam at the present time. You know, we are getting two different lines being put out. On the one, we are being told that Islam is a religion of bloodthirsty barbarians bent on war and slaughter and pillage and nothing else. On the other hand, there is the line that Islam is a religion of peace and love, rather like the Quakers but without their aggressiveness. You must have come across both of these versions.
Right.
Well, obviously, both are nonsense. The truth is in its usual place somewhere in the middle. But I think it would be useful to have an objective study of Islam to try and understand what this is about and to look at it as far as possible in their terms, not in ours.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. We're discussing his widely acclaimed book, What Went Wrong? This is Hugh LaFollette. Friday's Issues. Good day.